in the company of a new arrival, hence the rarity of her excursions into the city. Mary had been in transition, by her best guess, several months before she saw another new face. A fellow pirate, in fact, by the name Flora Byrne, who boasted that she died in a hail of cannon fire while fighting a pirate hunter in the waters off the Carolinas. Beyond that, Mother kept to herself, cloistered away like the holy woman she presented herself as. Visitors were never turned away, but she welcomed them coolly and rid herself of them quickly, as though she had urgent business to attend to. What that business might be was the foremost topic of speculation among Transition's denizens. Mary knocked on the door. Mother answered minutes later.
"Hello, Mary," she said.
"Rusla said you wanted to see me."
"No, not me."
Mother stepped aside. Mary entered. A woman, very old, sat in the front pew, her hunched back to the door. A crocheted shawl lay draped about her thin frame, and a snow-white braid hung down between her shoulder blades, its wispy tip nearly touching her tailbone.
"New arrival?" Mary asked.
The old woman sat bolt upright, and a whispery gasp escaped her lips. When she stood, she showed no signs of infirmity or frailty. Her skin possessed the leathern quality of someone who in her youth had spent much time in the sun. Deep creases crossed the plane of her forehead, gathered about the eyes, and parenthesized her mouth, while the apples of her cheeks were as smooth and shiny as polished marble. These were the wrinkles of someone who once smiled often. But Mary sensed those happy days were relegated to the old woman's youth, when life was a wild adventure, with no end in sight, while her later years were less joyous. That lost joy returned with the untamed power of an autumn hurricane, filling the old woman's sea-green eyes with a light that had long ago been snuffed out. But it burned again now, so very brightly, and any lingering doubt as to her identity vanished when she spoke. The face, the body, they were unrecognizable. But the voice with its faint Gaelic lilt, it rang like a brass bell.
"Mary," she said.
"My God,
Anne."
Mary nearly bowled Mother over in her mad dash to take her long-lost lover in her arms, to prove that she was really here, that it was really her. They held one another for so long, laughter giving way to joyous weeping. Mary stepped back and cradled Anne's face in her hands.
"You're so old,"
Mary said.
"Kunt,"
Anne said, grinning. She wiped her face dry on her sleeve.
"Mary, tell me there's an ocean."
"After a fashion."
"I want to see it."
Arm in arm, Mary led Anne through the streets of Transition toward the docks. The few people they passed regarded them with no more than passing curiosity, except for that haughty Hungarian bitch who mostly kept to herself. She shot the women a withering glance and marched on. When at last they reached the shore of the nameless gray sea, the sparkle in Anne's eyes, already as fierce as the summer sun, the real proper sun, intensified.
"It's not much to look at," Mary said.
"It's everything,"
Anne said, fresh tears falling. They sat at the edge of the pier. Anne interlaced her fingers with Mary's. Her grip was as firm as ever. She took a breath, exulting in the mild salt tang in the air.
"I haven't seen the water in years," she said.
"What happened to you after I..."
Mary couldn't finish the thought.
"My uncle was in Port Royal on business when we were captured. When he heard the news, he sent word to my father. He called in every favor anyone owed to him, surreptitiously paid a hefty ransom to the governor, and had me shipped to his home in Charleston, so he could tell me to my face what a great service he'd done me."
"And then?"
Anne gazed out toward the nebulous non-horizon.
"Father married me off as quickly as possible to make an honest woman of me. His name was Joseph Burley. We were married for nearly 50 years. I had 8 children by him.
Mary tried to picture the great Anne Bonny shepherding a pack of screaming nippers, or nursing an infant with the same tit she flashed at defeated opponents, to let them know they'd been bested by a mere woman. She almost laughed, but Anne's frown hinted that the story behind the story was not a happy story.
"Was he a good man?" Mary asked.
"He wasn't Jack. That was good enough."
Mary nodded.
"He wasn't you, either."
Anne stiffened, and her tone turned suddenly urgent.
"As soon as I landed in Charleston, I started making arrangements for my return to Port Royal. I was going to free you. The day we were to ship out, I received word you'd..."
She drew a hitching breath.
"Oh, Mary, I'm so sorry."
"Shh, don't you dare, Anne,"
Mary said, embracing her friend, her love.
"Don't you dare."
"I never should have left without you," Anne wept.
"You didn't."
Mary tipped Anne's face up and smiled. "You never left me."
"But I left you, and I can never forgive myself for that."
"You didn't."
"I did. In my heart, I did. When I heard you'd been..."
Anne worried at the edge of her shawl, wringing it like a damp washcloth.
"When I heard you were dead, I prayed for God to strike me down so I could be with you again. But no, the bastard kept me alive, aye?"
she shouted, directing the comment to the washed-out sky above. She laughed, an empty sound.
"I's convinced that maybe, just maybe, you'd gone to paradise. We weren't saints by any means, but I thought maybe the good Lord had enough mercy in his heart to let old Mary Reed into his presence, and that's the only reason I didn't put a pistol to my head. Those who do themselves, they're damned for sure, so the preachers say. I couldn't risk it. So I buried everything I felt for you, and played the good wife and good mother, for no reason other than to tip the scales, and earn my place in heaven."
"Hard to say whether that was a wasted effort," Mary said, looking about.
"But it doesn't matter. You're here. I'm here. Neither of us is going anywhere."
"Is that a fact?"
"That is a promise."
Mary laid a hand over Anne's heart and made a solemn vow. "If anyone tries to separate us again, that last night on the Revenge is going to look like a fancy dress ball. I will kill every man Jack what dares to tear us apart again. I'll spill blood until I drown in it. If I have to, I'll put a lead ball in God's eye and run through Lucifer himself. No one will ever again take you away from me, Anne Bonny." Anne, smiling, laid her head on Mary's shoulder.
"You are always the strong one," Anne said.
"Not always."
"When you needed to be. My Mary might get knocked down from time to time, but I knew you'd never stay down. Too much of the devil in you."
"Flatterer," Mary laughed.
"I missed you, Mary," Anne said. "So much. And I'll never leave you again. Never."
"I love you, Anne," Mary said.
"And I you. Always and forever.
Always and forever."
Rose awoke feeling more rested, more refreshed, more herself than she had in ages.
"Sergeant, hang back a minute," Owen said.
"Yes, ma'am," Rose said.
They waited until the rest of the morning patrol filed out of the ready room. Owens looked Rose up and down and asked,
"How are you today?"
"I'm doing all right," Rose stated plainly.
"Did you get some rest like I told you to?"
"I did. Slept like a rock."
Owens narrowed her eyes, taking Rose in again.
"Are you telling me what I want to hear, Sergeant?"
"No, LT, I am not. I am sound of mind and body and fit for duty." One final cursory inspection later, Owens returned to her lectern to grab a clipboard.
"You still have today and tomorrow left to justify my faith in you, but here's the detail schedule for the next couple of weeks. Take a look."
Rose scanned the list, most of which were traffic details for roadway repair jobs. Easy but stultifying gigs that entailed standing around in one of those hideous reflective orange safety harnesses, waving cars by, and ignoring the urgent demands of your bladder in exchange for obscene amounts of overtime. Thanks to savvy union negotiations, details were paid off in 4-hour blocks. Work an hour, get 4 hours pay. work 4 hours in 1 minute, take home 8 hours pay. Some of her colleagues had mastered the art of sniping the short details and took home effective annual salaries higher than the chief's. She caught the gasp before it could escape. "This one?" Rose said, pointing to an item on the schedule for Tuesday.
"Yeah, that's a presser at St. Vincent's, caught added late yesterday, I think," Owen said. "Couple hours, tops."
"That one," Rose demanded.
"I'll put you down as a solid maybe."
Owen scribbled Rose's initials next to the entry for the St. Vincent press conference security detail request. She asked Rose if she'd ever heard of the featured speaker. Owens said, "Erkan Waldemar." Rose heard, "Ernie Walmart."
"I think so," Rose said.
17. Erkan Waldemar, Worcester's Unsung Hero, by Walt Murrow. wmurrow@worcesterinsider.com. Erkan Waldemar might be the most important Worcester native you've never heard of. "I'm not one for the spotlight," Waldemar said during a rare interview, in and of itself a testament to his desire to keep his name out of the public eye. "I prefer to do my work quietly, behind the scenes. I'm not out for recognition or praise. A better, stronger, happier, safer Worcester is reward enough for me." The self-made shipping magnate grew up in a time when the city, according to many longtime residents, was not quite as good, strong, happy, or safe as it is today, and Waldemar can personally attest to that. His father, Drake Waldemar, a second-generation immigrant from Bucharest, was stabbed to death on his way home from work, 2 blocks away from the Chandler Hill home where young Erkan grew up, and where his mother, Ege Waldemar, still lives. "To say that was a pivotal moment in my life would be to understate it by a magnitude," Waldemar said. "To lose a parent at such a young age to street violence, it angered me, it saddened me, but it also galvanized me. The day we laid Papa to rest, I vowed I'd do everything in my power to prevent another child from suffering such a devastating loss." That personal crusade became the driving force in Waldemar's life. When he wasn't in school, he was hard at work, earning money for college, working at... Rose rubbed her eyes and took a sip of hotel coffee, now cooled to room temperature, and skimmed the rest of the fawning article, which made Erkan Waldemar sound like a cross between Warren Buffett, Jesus Christ, and Batman. Immediately after graduating from college, top of his class, of course, Waldemar found his niche in international shipping and capitalized on Worcester's location in the center of Massachusetts to grow his own import-export empire. His estimated net worth was a closely guarded secret. "I don't like to boast about such things. I find it gauche and self-aggrandizing," Waldemar said. But in the year before the article ran, the piece was almost 3 years old, Waldemar donated a total of $10 million to the city's schools and youth organizations, senior citizen support programs, and arts foundations. None of the donations were made anonymously, but Waldemar insisted that the recipients downplay his gifts, for modesty's sake. What a fucking saint. Why, then, did someone try to murder Erkan Waldemar 3 months ago? Waldemar and his wife were wrapping up their wedding anniversary celebrations, a very unlucky 13th, when the shooting occurred in front of their favorite restaurant, a fancy steakhouse that charged more for filet mignon than Rose had ever paid for a full meal. A male suspect, possibly Hispanic, jumped out of a silver Pontiac, model unknown, bearing tags later reported stolen off a car parked at the Greendale Mall, and opened fire with a small automatic weapon, tentatively identified as a micro Uzi. Waldemar took 2 bullets in the chest, 2 more in the abdomen. A 5th grazed his skull. His bodyguard, Randolph Hammond, took a slug in the right bicep. Isabel Waldemar escaped uninjured. The investigation that followed was impressively thorough. Rose flipped through the copy of the report she'd printed out at work,
a hefty document, complete with initial and multiple follow-up interviews with the victims and several witnesses, crime scene photos, ballistics, the whole shebang, and then some. Sure, 2 dozen regular folks got shot last year, and they were rushed through the system. But shoot one rich guy, and he gets the 27 8x10 color glossy photos with circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one explaining what each one was. To no avail, however. A cruel irony for all that effort. The man who shot Erkan Valdemar was never positively identified, much less caught, and the whole thing was ascribed to an act of random gang violence. Rose read through the reports again and again and again, and each rereading affirmed her initial gut suspicion and locked it into her brain. A single gunman, armed with an Uzi. Who the hell uses an Uzi anymore? Getting out of a car with stolen tags to unload on a single, decidedly atypical target for gangbangers, and the official call was gang violence? Bullshit gang violence. This was a hit. Rose nodded off amidst her nest of the Valdemar shooting report, the question of who might have wanted to take the man out still unanswered, and not so much as a half-assed theory presenting itself. Valdemar himself was squeaky clean, on paper anyway. But no one attracts an assassination attempt without doing something to earn it. Whenever the opportunities presented themselves, Rose poked and prodded around the department's records, all the way back to Drake Valdemar's murder, the only other time the name Valdemar appeared in the system. The senior Valdemar's death was wholly unsuspicious. He was walking home after closing up for the evening. He night-managed a liquor store, when a strung-out addict demanded his wallet at knife point. Drake Valdemar resisted and took a steak knife to the belly for his troubles. When he tried to call for help, his assailant silenced him by sawing through his jugular. The perp confessed to everything when he turned himself in 3 hours later. After getting his fix, of course. Rose made sure to keep her excursions quiet and her highly dubious theory to herself. Wild hunches based on evidence so flimsy it didn't even rise to the level of circumstantial might be cause enough for swift, decisive, and uncannily accurate accusations in bad action flicks and TV procedurals. But in real life, recklessness like that got cops shit-canned. Not that she wasn't tempted. All that kept the impulse in check was that note in her phone's calendar for Tuesday, 10 a.m., the one she'd entered before Owens had formally confirmed her for the gig. St. Vin's, Valdemar Presser. The last time Rose came to St. Vincent's, she was carried in on a stretcher, and she was technically dead. It wasn't a full-fledged panic attack, but Rose had to grip her belt to stop her hands from shaking. She knew this made her appear cocky and self-important. Owens called it the Officer Billy J. Badass pose. But looking overly confident was preferable to looking pants-shittingly terrified. Breathe in, 3, 4. Breathe out, 3, 4. Rose entered. The short ride down on a glass elevator gave her an excellent view of the floor she'd be working. The main body of St. Vincent's was lovely and inviting, and as far from clinical as it could get. The presser would take place in the atrium, which at a glance could pass for the food court of an upscale mall. Wooden tables and chairs fit for alfresco dining on the deck of a country club had been cleared away to make room for a small stage and lectern, behind which loomed a small but impressive faux waterfall. Water gently spilled over a sculpted rock facade, surrounded by greenery. Real trees, living, breathing trees, soaking in the sunlight pouring through an angled glass ceiling. The presser area proper, cordoned off with velvet ropes strung between silvery stanchions, bustled with activity as reporters, hospital staff, and invited guests milled about, glad-handing and small-talking in advance of the main event. A pair of TV news camera people set up their rigs one next to the other, their respective station affiliations a non-issue. A good angle was a good angle. Rose made her own idle chit-chat with the other three officers assigned to the detail. The usual inane shop talk for the most part. But Mendez wondered aloud, not really in search of an answer, why something as simple as a press conference
warranted such security. Ingracia speculated it might have something to do with Erkan Valdemar's shooting.
Something like that's bound to make a guy paranoid, Ingracia said.
So let him hire some bodyguards, Mendez said.
But then we wouldn't get the OT.
There's that, yeah.
Halford, a rookie with less than 6 months' service to his name, said,
Man, if I'd been nearly shot to death, last thing I'd...
Fuck's sake, Doug, Mendez said in a low hiss.
He nodded toward Rose. Halford delivered his awkward apology to Rose's back. The press conference began at 10 sharp. Rose tuned out the opening act, the hospital director blathering on at unnecessary length to remind everyone how important he was. The mayor followed, but knew enough to keep his remarks short and sweet and bland, and only strayed into self-appreciation once, that occasion coupled with a gentle reminder that he'd be seeking re-election in the fall. The director returned to make the big introduction for the man of the hour. Local businessman, philanthropist, and true friend of St. Vincent's, Erkan Valdemar. Rose's gasp was lost in the enthusiastic applause that broke out as Valdemar, arm in arm with his wife, Isabel, descended a short stairway, splitting the simulated cliff face. He stepped up to the lectern, Isabel at his shoulder, offered his audience a modest bow, and held up a hand that both expressed gratitude and called for quiet. The applause dwindled to a smatter, like the last drops of a rainstorm that had spent itself.
Not too long ago, my good friend Nurse Lauren said, I hope I never see you in this hospital again.
Erkan began, drawing a chuckle. He pointed to someone in the audience. Rose craned her head but couldn't make out the target of his acknowledgement.
I told him I'd be back when the hospital named a wing after me. Well, I'm not getting a wing named after me, but not for lack of effort.
Rose didn't hear a word after that. The speech dissolved into gray fuzz, like static, and she stared at Erkan Valdemar, her heart thundering and her blood roaring in her ears. She blinked. The speech was done, and Valdemar was handing over the obligatory giant prop check to the hospital director. The amount was 7 figures. Valdemar and his wife descended into the crowd amidst a lightning storm of camera flashes. Bodies jockeyed for position to extend a greeting or a word of gratitude, or to simply get noticed by so important and so generous a man. The Valdemars endured the circus with gracious smiles, always under the watchful eye of a man in a plain black suit, who stood literally head and shoulders above the crowd. At last the scrum began to fray at the edges. The reporters and photographers and camera crews packed up so they might hustle back from whence they came and file their stories. Hospital officials and staff floated away to form little islands of side conversation to prolong their brief furloughs from work. The logjam broken, the Valdemars picked up the pace, eager, it seemed, to be done with the necessary public spectacle. Rose found herself in their path. "Mr. Valdemar," she said.
"Hello?" Erkan glanced at her stripes. "Sergeant, can I help you with something?"
"We..." Rose choked down the gnawing dread trying to climb up her throat. "I wanted to meet you. We share an experience."
"Oh?"
"I was shot in the line of duty almost a year ago. It was in the news."
"Ah."
Rose plastered on a fake smile. "I just wanted to say I admire what you did here today. After I was shot, I was treated here at St. Vincent's. Safe to say they saved my life."
"Kindred spirits, it would seem," Isabel remarked.
"It appears so," Erkan said. "Well, it was lovely to meet you, Sergeant..."
"Booker. Rose Booker."
"Rose Booker," Erkan said, as if committing the name to memory, and that caused Rose's spine to become a column of solid ice. She now understood the truth about Erkan Valdemar, but he, no doubt, understood the truth about her as well.
Once back in her cruiser, once she got her hands under control well enough she could hold her phone without dropping it, Rose called Julie. She barely got her greeting out.
"I need to see Mother. Now."
"What's wrong?"
Julie said. Anne, somewhere in the background, echoed the question.
I need to see Mother. Is she at the church?
I do not know. Probably. I am fairly certain she lives there.
Rose, what is wrong?
I found another one.
Another?
Another one what?
Erkan Valdemar, Rose said. He's awakened. Mother's eyes blazed with a cold fire.
Are you positive? She said.
It was the same feeling I got when I met Julie and you and Anne, Rose said. The same feeling. I knew him. Mother settled back in her seat. The folding chair creaked beneath her, protesting. It was the last sound Rose would hear for several minutes, and she was the one who eventually broke the intolerable silence.
You told me awakening happens to women, but maybe it happens to men too, she said.
I mean, there's no reason it couldn't, right?
There's no reason it would, Mother countered. I'm unaware of...
But you can't say for sure, can you? You don't know everything, that's what you told me.
No.
So it is possible Valdemar is awakened.
It is possible, I suppose, she relented. But why does this man concern you so much, Mary?
I think he has something to do with some recent disappearances, Rose said, relating to Mother the connection, as tenuous as it was, between Arnold Park, Moby Mantle, and Tamir Ray Johnson. Plus, he was the target of a distinctly gangland-style shooting about 3 months ago. It was written off as random gang violence.
Might it have been?
No. No way. We haven't seen an incident like that in Worcester since before I joined the department. Besides, why would a street gang go after a wealthy white businessman?
Be careful, Sergeant. Your casual racism is showing.
Sorry. Point is, the details of the incident are all wrong. Nothing about this says random act of violence.
To you?
I am a cop, you know.
That doesn't mean you're incapable of being wrong. It is possible this was, in fact, a truly random act of violence, isn't it?
Throwing my own argument back in my face?
Goose meet gander.
Yes, it is possible, but it's not probable.
What would you like me to do? Mother asked. What can I do about it?
Look into it. Find out if Valdemar is awakened.
The best way to do that would be to bring him here.
I'd rather not involve you in this directly.
Only indirectly, Mother said dryly.
I need to know.
Why? Would it impact your investigation?
Rose skirted around the fact there was, on paper, no investigation. I don't know. It might. If I'm right and someone took a deliberate run at Valdemar, that means he did something to piss off someone wealthy enough, connected enough, and morally bankrupt enough to hire a professional hitman. And that means Valdemar himself is suspect.
Mother folded her arms. Are you trying to convince me or yourself?
I have a theory. I'm exploring it, that's all.
If you say so.
Will you help me or not?
I'll do what I can, but I make no promises I'll be of use.
I just need to know you'll be here if I need you.
Mother took Rose's hand. That's why I'm here.
The knotwork of Rose's neck and shoulders loosened, ever so slightly. Before leaving, Rose added Mother to her directory to avoid playing literal telephone through Julie. She returned to her hotel room, planning to take a long hot shower, perhaps even a bath, and then indulge in bad Chinese takeout and cheap wine before sacking out. Erkan Valdemar could wait. The bath was glorious. She remained in the tub until her fingertips were deeply pruned and the water cooled, and she emerged feeling relaxed, if not refreshed. That all went away when her phone rang and she made the mistake of answering. The number came up as unknown caller, but she knew the man on the other end. Worse? He knew her. Hello, Sergeant Booker. This is Erkan Valdemar.
18.
We met at the St. Vincent's press conference the other day, Erkan said when his initial greeting drew pronounced silence.
Yeah, I remember you. Rose cleared her throat as quietly as she could. What can I do for you, Mr. Valdemar?
Actually, Sergeant, I was calling to see if there was anything I could do for you.
Do for... I don't understand.
You left quite the impression following our brief meeting, on myself and my wife. This was her idea, in fact.
Rose dug her fingernails into her thigh, using the pain to steady the tremor in her voice. What was her idea?
I asked around, did a little checking up on you, about the incident that landed you in the hospital, to be precise. I must say, what you did was very heroic.
No, Rose said immediately. No, it wasn't. Killing a man wasn't heroic.
An abusive husband is hardly a man, Sergeant. Simply my opinion. And you did act in self-defense. It's not as if you enjoyed it.
No.
No, of course not.
Mr. Valdemar, what do you want?
I'm sorry, I'm getting off topic, aren't I? I understand police benefits are generally excellent. But you know the American healthcare system. It can make paupers of anyone under the right circumstances. I wanted to see if you needed any assistance with your medical bills.
Assistance?
Financial assistance, yes. If you have any bills you need paid off.
No, I'm fine, I'm... The question slipped out. Why?
I'm sorry.
Why would you offer to pay off my medical bills? You don't even know me.
As my wife noted, we're kindred spirits. We share an experience, and I'm always looking for ways to support our local police.
That's very generous of you, but I'm fine. I don't need anything.
Good to hear, Erkan said cheerily. Well, if you should ever find yourself in need, please feel free to contact me. It's been nice talking to you, Sergeant. Keep up the good work. I look forward to following your career.
Rose ran to Julie and Anne's shared room and made it through the door before the bomb in her chest detonated. Anne's best efforts to talk her down fell far short.
Let her get it out of her system, Julie said. Willa used to experience panic attacks. The only reliable remedy was to let them run their course.
Are you sure? Anne said.
It should not take long. That is the mixed blessing of fear. It burns hot, but it burns fast.
The adrenaline crash that followed hit hard. Rose sank onto the end of Anne's bed and dropped her head between her legs to ward off the sudden dizzy spell. Anne knelt before her and held her hands, and spoke to her, quietly, told her to breathe. Just breathe, nice and slow. Breathe in, 3, 4. Breathe out, 3, 4. When her head finally stopped spinning like a tornado, and she was able to speak without her gag reflex threatening to trigger, Rose told them about Erkan Valdemar's call. She told them everything.
Christ almighty, Anne said with a low whistle. And what could he possibly want with you?
I don't know, Rose said, but it has to have something to do with us both being awakened.
You don't know that for sure?
He knows. He has to. If I could sense it from him, he...
But you don't.
We have to assume that is the case, Julie said. We cannot talk ourselves into believing otherwise.
We can't talk ourselves into panic without evidence either, Anne said.
My way is safer.
Your way will have Mary jumping at shadows.
Just because one is paranoid.
Julie's right, Rose said. Better safe than sorry.
I suppose, Anne said.
She sat next to Rose and slipped an arm around her waist. You know I have your back, don't you?
We both do, Julie said.
Anne, Julie, no, I can't, Rose began.
Not up for debate, Anne said.
Her embrace tightened. Whatever shit you're in, we're in it too.
Hear, hear, Julie said. We reincarnated ladies have to stick together.
Rose's phone went off. Oh, God, now what? She muttered. She dug her phone out of her pocket and glared at the screen.
I'm in the lobby.
Fucking hell. Rose strode into the lobby, a tidy, tastefully decorated space. A long sofa and two easy chairs bracketed a glass-top coffee table, upon which an assortment of pamphlets spotlighting local attractions had been artfully fanned out. A television hung on the wall above a fake fireplace, complete with a pile of plastic logs that could never pass at any distance as authentic. Calvin got out of his seat near the decorative hearth. Rose crossed her arms and waited for her unexpected, unwelcome caller to speak.
Your father told me you were staying here, he said, answering a question Rose hadn't raised.
That made sense. Devin Booker adored Calvin and wasn't shy about asking when he might join the family. And then help Rose expand it. He wanted grandkids, damn it.
What do you want?
Calvin's eyes flicked toward the desk clerk, a middle-aged woman who returned his look tenfold, making it clear she wasn't going anywhere. She belonged there. He didn't.
I want to talk to you. I've been calling and texting since you left.
I know. Look, this really isn't a good time.
Rose.
Calvin, I can't do this right now. I am eyeball deep in 31 flavors of shit, and the last thing I need is to get sucked into another pointless argument with you.
But how are we supposed to work this out if you won't talk to me?
Oh, now you want to talk? She said. But it was a fair enough question, nevertheless.
Rose,
Calvin said. The love in his eyes was as strong as ever.
Please, let's work this out.
I don't want to work it out.
You what?
I don't want to work it out, Rose said, and all the tension she carried in her shoulders, a weight like a yoke for a team of oxen, floated away. She nearly swooned. Calvin sputtered and stammered and grasped for a response, and then finally forced out,
Why?
Why? Because there is nothing to work out. You want me to give up a job I don't want to leave. One of us has to back down, and I don't... She paused. If I quit, or even if I took that desk job, I would resent you for forcing me to make that choice. And I'd resent myself for making it. That's not a hypothetical, that's how it would be. I'd be giving up something I've wanted my whole life, that I worked my ass off for, to put your mind at ease. And all that would do is make me miserable.
I'll learn to deal with it, Calvin said.
You can't keep that promise. You've had 9 months to learn to deal with it, and you haven't...
Rose.
No.
Give me a chance.
No.
Rose, please.
No. Nothing is going to change, and I can't... I don't want to do this anymore. It's exhausting. Aren't you exhausted? Calvin's brow creased. His lips arched into a scowl.
So that's it. You're just going to throw away a 7-year relationship?
I'm not throwing it away. I'm admitting it's over. Another weight fell away, and despite herself, Rose Booker smiled. It ended the day I died. She told Calvin she would be by to get her things from the apartment. Probably not tomorrow, probably not for a few days, but she would get them. She would attend to this somber task while he was at work, so he wouldn't have to watch, and so she wouldn't have to again endure the same desolation in Calvin's eyes she saw before turning away from him and walking back to the elevator. A knock. A soft, Hello? The clock radio told Rose it was a little past 6.
She'd been sitting on the edge of her bed in a fugue state for 2 hours. She stood, her back creaking, and shambled over to the door, as though dragging leaden weights chained about her ankles. Anne greeted her with a deep frown. Rose slumped against the wall and let her enter.
"What happened?" Anne asked.
Rose shook her head and wandered away, whatever she was about to say forgotten. She turned, hugging herself, her gaze distant.
"It's over," she said at last, the announcement hollow. "I'm sorry."
Anne touched Rose lightly on the arm.
"Did he?"
"No, I did." Anne nodded. Her hand slid up to Rose's shoulder, eliciting a tiny shiver.
"I'm sorry," she said again. "It was overdue." "Still," Anne said, and she brushed Rose's cheek with the back of her fingertips.
Rose closed her eyes and let out a whisper-light sigh. The fingers moved to the back of her neck and gently drew her in. Their lips touched. And then Anne flailed back, catching the corner of Rose's bed on the back of her leg. She fell over awkwardly, cracking her elbow on the floor. Rose loomed over her, seething.
"What the fuck was that?" Rose demanded.
I thought... Anne stammered.
"What? What did you think? That I'm fair game now? Fucking hell, Anne, I broke up with my boyfriend 2 hours ago."
"No, I wasn't..." Anne got to her feet. Her upper arm throbbed.
"I'm sorry, Mary. I..."
"Rose!" she roared, her face blazing red.
"I am not Mary fucking Reed. My name is Rose Booker."
Anne recoiled from the sheer force of Rose's rage, her hands up as if in surrender, as if braced for an attack. She stuttered a whimpering apology and ran from the room with a choked sob. A sob that Rose echoed as she sank to the floor, deflating as her anger subsided, and then flickered out like a dying bonfire.
"My name is Rose Booker," she wept.
"Rose?" She sat up. She had no memory of climbing into bed, but there she was. The clock claimed a full 12 hours had passed since Anne left in tears. She tried to speak, but her throat was scoured raw from crying. Julie called out again. Rose swung her feet down to the floor and stood, a belt of dull pain tightening around her waist and digging into the base of her spine. She shuffled across the room, let Julie in, and returned to bed.
"Oh, my dear sergeant," Julie said.
She sat on the edge of the bed.
"How are you?"
"I don't know," Rose said. And she wept again, tapping a fresh well of misery that took a long time to drain. When the tears abated, she said,
"I broke up with Calvin."
"Yes, Anne told me."
"You know what the worst part is? You know what I felt when I ended it? Relief. Not grief or loss. Not regret, just... It was like I'd cast off this millstone I'd been carrying around forever. And I don't know if it's because Rose Booker was happy she finally pulled her head out of her ass and admitted she was stuck in a dead-end relationship, or because Mary Reed didn't love Calvin."
Julie nodded, a gesture that conveyed simple understanding and no more.
"I can feel her fighting to take over," Rose said. "All the weird thoughts and impulses I've felt ever since I died, they're getting stronger. Yesterday, Mother called me Mary. She called me Mary twice. I didn't correct her. It never occurred to me."
"Why would it? You are Mary Reed."
"Mary Reed died 4 centuries ago. She had her turn. This is my life now, goddammit, and I do not want to be replaced by someone else."
Rose sat up on her elbows.
"But I can't stop it, can I?"
Julie, fumbling in the dark to find the faintest glimmer of hope, said,
"As long as you are still having the dreams."
"I'm not."
"What?"
"I stopped having them right after I met Anne. And ever since that night, I've felt Mary fighting to get out.
I don't know if I can stop her.
If anyone can, it would be you, Rose Booker.
The spirit to smile, albeit faintly, was there. The flesh would not comply.
Do you need anything? Julie asked.
No.
If you do, please let me know.
I will.
Promise me.
You sound worried.
I am.
I'm not going to do anything stupid.
I should hope not. That is my job.
That earned Julie a brief, feeble, but heartfelt laugh.
Promise me, Rose. You are the only person in this world who actually gives a damn about me. I am not about to let you go without a fight.
She bent and placed a gentle kiss on Rose's forehead. Rose stopped her at the door. Julie?
Yes?
Tell Anne I'm sorry for blowing up at her.
Of course.
Rose blinked and found she'd jumped in time once again. She had no firm recollection of Julie actually leaving, but she was indeed gone, and 5 hours had sneaked by unnoticed. Curious despite herself, she checked her phone. 2 missed calls, neither from Calvin, which surprised her, but the one from her father did somehow smack of Calvin adjacency. The other was from an unknown caller who left no voicemail. Rose shuddered. Her only other recent unknown caller had been Erkan Valdemar. 19. In police work, there was a fine but ill-defined line between insistence and harassment, and that line constantly moved and shifted like a desert dune. There were few firm thresholds codified in the law that did not involve a court order. Almost all of them pertained to how often creditors and collection agencies could reach out to a customer with a debt, which left officers to make judgment calls based on the players and the game they were playing. Sergeant Rose Booker, despite being one of the players this time around, could not say in her honest professional opinion that she was being harassed by Erkan Valdemar, a.k.a. Unknown Caller. For 4 straight days, he towed but did not cross that nebulous line, calling once each day, always at a reasonable hour. He never left a voicemail, but every non-message filled Rose with white-knuckle terror. Insistent, yes. Harassing, no. Sunday passed without a single unknown call, as did Monday, as did Tuesday. Devin Booker did not give up so easily. She couldn't say whether Calvin was accepting the breakup gracefully, but he was accepting it silently. He hadn't contacted her once since that day in the lobby. Her father, however, decided to take up arms on Calvin's behalf, and he called at least twice a day under the guise of checking in on his only child. Those check-ins eventually turning into gentle pleas to at least try to make it work, and maybe consider talking to a professional therapist. Because I'd hate to see you throw away your relationship. He's a good man. Rose gave up trying to impress upon him her position. He didn't want to hear it. His own near miss with divorce irrevocably narrowed his perspective and turned him into a disciple of the Church of Couples Therapy. It saved his marriage to Marcy Booker and allowed him to enjoy 5 very happy years with his wife before cervical cancer took its cruel toll, and he staunchly believed any relationship could be saved. He couldn't, or wouldn't, entertain the notion that sometimes a shared path was no longer the best path.
I'd hate to see you throw away your relationship. He's a good man.
He was. She admitted that. He was just no longer good for her. Rose pulled into the empty driveway, stepped out of her car, and paused to take a final mental snapshot of the stately Victorian house she and Calvin called home for 6 years out of their 7-year relationship. It was a big step up from the tenement they'd lived in previously. An ugly box of a thing, with no personality outside of its butt-ugly mauve vinyl siding. Their landlady was a lovely woman who grew up in the home and inherited it from her mother after her passing. Rather than move in herself, she had each floor converted to its own apartment. It was too much house for her alone, she remarked on the day she showed Rose and Calvin the top floor unit, and it held too many memories. All of them good, she said, but that only made the notion of living there herself more painful. Too many memories. Not all of them good, certainly not the more recent memories, but good enough that Rose could appreciate Mrs. Malick's decision. The wide front porch was technically available to all residents, but the ground floor tenants, the Kerrs, treated it like their sovereign domain. It was their barbecue grill out there, and their two young boys' bikes, and they were quick to gripe to one neighbor whenever the other dared to stake a claim, oblivious to the fact no one was on their side. Certainly not Gilbert and Chaz Harvey, who had the misfortune of living above the Kerrs. The children were rambunctious screamers and squealers. The parents were shouters. And, from time to time, screamers and squealers. A red Schwinn leaned up against the screen door leading to the main stairwell. Rose moved it and went upstairs. The third floor landing, a short hallway, was predictably warm and humid. Summertime was a few weeks away yet, but springtime was when the climate on the third floor started to become oppressive. Heat rising from the lower floors, coupled with the home's lack of decent air circulation, worked to their advantage in the wintertime. Their gas bill never rose above $30 a month. But once the ice and snow retired for the year, the place turned into an oven. The air conditioners in the living room and bedroom ran constantly from April to early November. They were running now, their whispery hum prominent in the otherwise silent apartment. The drone soon faded into the background, becoming subliminal as Rose made a slow orbit around the living room. A mini-metropolis of beer bottles and Chinese takeout boxes had spread across the coffee table, during her absence. But it was the only spot of mess or chaos she could find. She wandered into the kitchen and found the sink empty for once. Sure, now he learns how to do dishes, she thought. But then she corrected herself. If Calvin had been eating nothing but takeout, there'd be no dishes to clean. Rose began in the bathroom. That didn't take long. She threw her hair dryer and curling iron she hadn't used in years, not since she got her hair cut short, into her duffel bag, along with a handful of toiletries and makeup. Half her wardrobe went into the bag, the other half stayed on their hangers and in their drawers, where they'd no doubt remain until Calvin stuffed them into garbage bags and dropped them off at Goodwill. Or burned them on the lawn. Most of her books she left behind out of sheer necessity. A battered paperback copy of Nothing Lasts Forever by Roderick Thorpe, the novel that served as the basis for Die Hard, went with her, along with a couple of older Stephen King hardcovers. The Encyclopedia Piratical went in, and then promptly came out again. She tossed it onto the couch and left it there. Six of her favorite Blu-rays, a framed photo of her with her parents posed in front of a squat lighthouse taken during a weekend vacation to the Cape, a pudgy Maneki Neko figurine she picked up during a day trip to Chinatown in Boston because she thought its fat, smiling face was adorable. A box of cartridges for her handgun she kept tucked away on a high shelf in the front closet. They all went into the bag. Everything else stayed where it was. She scribbled a note to Calvin and left it atop the honeycomb of beer bottlenecks. "We'll be back for the rest later. Please don't throw out my books." Rose flinched, startled by a knock at the front door, the polite rapping of a casual caller.
"Hey, Rose, you home?"
It took her a few seconds to place the voice. She answered the door to find an out-of-uniform Aldwin in the hall. "Hey, what are you doing here?"
"Hello to you, too,"
he said, peering over the top of a pair of mirrored sunglasses suitable for a southern county sheriff. "Sorry," Rose beckoned Aldwin inside. "I've been having a shitty week."
"Yeah, I heard you and Calvin were going through another rough patch or something."
"Could say that. We broke up."
"Oh, geez, Rose, I'm sorry to hear."
Aldwin looked around.
"You kick him out?"
"I kicked myself out. I just came to pick up a few things."
"You have a new place already?"
Rose picked her bag up and threw it over her shoulder. "No, I haven't started looking. I'm in a hotel for now."
"Is that why you've been taking detail work?"
Yeah, I'd rather not dip into what little savings I have for first, last, and security.
I hear you.
Rose stood at the door, her hand hovering over the doorknob. She couldn't stop herself from looking back. The living room sat before her like an old photograph, faded and dull. She waited for a wistful memory to come to her, a moment of joy or sadness to hang on to and hold in her heart for as long as it still belonged to her. She waited. Rose stepped into the hall and locked the door behind her.
If you're hard up for money, I can help you out, Aldwyn said.
Oh, God, Joe, no. I can't take money from you.
You wouldn't be taking it from me.
Rose's mouth went bone dry. Aldwyn had never been to her place before. He didn't know where she lived. And even if he did, he had no way of knowing whether she was home. Not unless he'd been staking the place out. You never answered my question, she said. What are you doing here?
I wanted to talk to you.
You couldn't have talked to me at work?
About this? Aldwyn gave a slow shake of his head. This is a conversation best held in private.
Rose lowered her bag to the floor and stole a glance past Aldwyn, who had, by accident or design, placed himself in front of the stairway.
Someone's taken an interest in you, he said.
Someone? Rose said. You mean Erkan Valdemar.
He asked about you. Wanted to know what kind of cop you were. I told him you were damn good at your job. You believed in the work, that you were maybe a little underappreciated by the higher-ups. And when push came to shove, you had no problem, laying down the law.
What the hell is that supposed to mean? Aldwyn leaned in and said in an unnecessary whisper,
I stole a peek at your psyche, Val. I saw what you said about Alex, what's his name?
I didn't say anything about Alex Cornelius. I don't know what...
Cornelius, Aldwyn said with a snap of his fingers. That was the guy's name. Oh, you said something, all right. You said you didn't regret putting a bullet in his brain.
I never said that.
Yes, you did. You said, I'm not sorry I killed that girlfriend beating piece of shit, and that is a direct quote.
Rose shook her head, a denial, and a lie. That was months ago. I was angry. I wasn't thinking straight.
Hey, I'm not passing judgment here. And if I were, I'd be pinning a goddamn medal to your chest.
Aldwyn grinned.
So would Mr. Valdemar. You're the kind of people he wants on his side. And trust me, he rewards his kind of people pretty damn well.
Jesus Christ, Joe.
Before you get any wrong ideas, he wouldn't ask you to run around gunning people down. God no, nothing like that. All he wants is another ear to the ground, another set of eyes on the inside.
Another? How many people does he have in the department?
Sorry, Rose, trade secret. Let's just say Mr. Valdemar has a lot of friends all over the place.
Great, then he doesn't need me, Rose said, her fear giving way to something that burned hotter.
Why don't you give it some thought and I'll...
There's nothing to think about. Whatever you're selling, I'm not buying.
Rose.
No. The answer is no. I don't want anything to do with Valdemar. Or you.
Ah, shit, Aldwyn said, sagging. Damn it. I really thought you'd want to... Shit. Shit, shit, shit. Ah, Rose.
Aldwyn reached for something hidden under his jacket. Rose lunged, coming in low, ramming her shoulder into Aldwyn's gut and driving him back. He teetered at the top of the stairs, but at the last instant saved himself, grabbing onto the corner where the top of the stairwell and the end of the hallway met. Rose seized his wrist and pried his hand loose. Aldwyn toppled over, but his fall did not turn into a head-over-heels tumble to the next landing. He rolled once and became lodged in the narrow stairwell like a cork in a bottleneck. Rose instinctively reached for her gun, only to remember upon finding a blank spot on her belt, she'd left it back at the hotel, dutifully sealed in its lockbox and hidden in a dresser drawer. She turned and ran, intending to take the fire escape mounted on the back of the house, maybe grab a knife from the kitchen on the way through. The apartment door, the one she'd instinctively locked behind her, held fast. She dove into her pocket and frantically fished for her key. Aldwyn, his sunglasses askew on his face,
stomped up the stairs.
"Christ," he said, baring his teeth. "Had to make this hard."